Good afternoon, calling State of First Order at 3:04 p.m. Our most punctual meeting start in probably 2 months. It's Thursday, April 21, 2022. We're in the Max Grunberg room, and members present from my left to my right, Representatives Tar, Kaufman, Story, and I, Chair Grace Tompkins, am also here. We have four members present, therefore a quorum for business. Thanks, as always, to Sophia with House Records and Lydia in the back of the room with LAA for facilitating today's meeting, as well as Jeff Stepp, our committee aide. And a couple of housekeeping items as we react to the ever-dynamic realities of the legislature. HB 66 is going to be rolled up towards the top of today's agenda. We're also removing HB 271, the ADA bill, from today's agenda, and we should hear it on Tuesday instead, giving the sponsor a little bit more time to react to questions that were raised in the previous hearing. And that takes us to a slightly condensed agenda with merely six bills, although a couple of them should be quick. And I think it was previously noticed, committee members, we may recess and come back in the evening at 7:45. That will not be the case. And in fact, I think we're going to try to wrap things up by 5:15. And if that means rolling certain bills to next day's hearing, so be it. And we've advised at least one bill sponsor that they may be severable from today's agenda if we are time limited. So we'll try to hustle, and I'll try to time budget accordingly. So the first item on today's agenda is HB 396. This is the Russian Divestment Committee legislation, and there was a CS that was previously distributed to committee members by email, so I'm going to entertain a motion to adopt the CS. I might turn to Representative Tar if you might be able to make a quick spot motion to put the CS on the table.
Yes, I can do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move to adopt the committee substitute for House Bill 396, version I, as our working document.
I'll object for presentation purposes. Ms. Forseth, please come forward, and if you can speak to what is in the CS, we can consider adoption.
Of course. Good afternoon, members of the House State Affairs Committee. Thank you for hearing House Bill 396. So I'll be going through the explanation of changes, and hopefully that will bring to light what the changes are in the CS. So Section 1, Page 1, Sections A and B were revised to change the divestment timeline from 90 to 180 days. On Page 1, Lines 11, 13, and 14, and on Page 2, Line 6. This conforms with the administration's timeline in HB 401. Section 1, okay. That's the first change. Second change. Section 1, page 3, section G, lines 5 through 7, specifies that the commissioner or a fiduciary of the fund is not required to divest from an investment under this section if the commissioner or fiduciary determines that divestment is not consistent with the fiduciary responsibilities of the commissioner or the fiduciary. This change reflects concerns about fiduciary duty expressed in both HB 394, Representative Eastman's divestment bill, and HB 401, the governor's divestment bill. The goal of this new language is to give APFC a relief valve and to guide public funds to divest when they deem it fiscally prudent to do so. We intend for this added language to be a jumping-off point for discussion by the committee regarding the goals of this divestment bill. The next change is in Section 1, Page 3, Section I, Line 13. It adds debt instrument issued by the government of Russia to the definition of Russian entity. This change conforms to the administration's divestment bill. The next change is Section 1, Page 3, Section I, Lines 20 and 21. It explains that the definition of Russian entity does not include a company the United States federal government excludes from federal sanctions related to Russia. So if a company is not included on OFAC's list, or if it is removed, that company is no longer regarded as a Russian entity under this legislation. This conforms to the administration's divestment bill as well. Next change is section 2, page 3, section A, lines 22 through 26. It specifies that the uncodified law shall establish guidelines for transition, stating that within 30 days after the effective date of this act, the Commissioner of Revenue shall create an initial list of Russian entities. This revision was added to clarify an aspect of the divestment timeline that was vague in the original version of the bill. It means that within 30 days of the effective date, the list of Russian entities will be created, and 150 days after those initial 30 days, the public funds must divest. Finally, section 2, page 3, line 27 to page 4, line 4, section B, establishes that section 1G, previously mentioned, of this act notwithstanding, the Commissioner of Revenue, a fiduciary of fund subject to AS 37, or an outside investment manager shall, within 180 days after the effective date, divest ownership in the initial list of Russian entities created, and specified that the Commissioner of Revenue or the fiduciary shall submit a letter consistent with Section 1B to the manager of a commingled investment. This revision was added to clarify an aspect of the divestment timeline that was vague in the original version of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Borseth. Let the record reflect that Representative Eastman joined us approximately 3:05 p.m. and Representative Plainman approximately 3:09 p.m. and Representative Vance is excused today, and Representative Kaufman may need to leave us circa 3:45 for previously noted other obligations. Are there questions on the CS? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this was the same in the original version of the bill, but I just wanted to ask about the repealer. So Section 1 of this act is repealed January 1, 2024. And I'm just thinking, is that the same timeline that the legislation that's kind of being merged in this bill had? I was just trying to remember if 1 was 2025, but I might be remembering that incorrectly.
Ms. Borseth?
To my knowledge, that date, Zanny Borseth, staff representative, Christ Tompkins through the chair, Representative Tarr, to my knowledge, that date has been consistent, but I can do a comparison and get back to the committee. And
is that the A version?
We are on the I version, and the A version was the original. The B version was what we had. Let me just get this right. Are you going to say something?
Okay.
A to I. Yeah.
Sorry, what was that
reference? A version says 2024.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the A version says January 1st, 2024. The governor's bill expires on July 1st, 2023.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was remembering, and I thought there was a different date in there. And so actually ours then would be later, which I like. Okay, thank you.
Other questions on the CS? Seeing none, I will remove my objection. Is there further objection to the CS? Seeing none, version I is adopted as our working document as the CS for House Bill 396. Close the loop while people joined us as close to 3 o'clock as possible. There is public testimony noticed on HB 396. I'm going to go ahead and open public testimony. I don't believe anybody in the room is here to testify for House Bill 396, but online we have Karen Matias in Anchorage. If you can hear us, please go ahead, put yourself on record, and present your testimony in 3 or fewer minutes.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Karen Matias from Anchorage, and I'm representing myself. I support HB 396 to divest investments in Russian entities. Normally, I strongly believe the managers of the permanent fund should stick to their mandate to make investment decisions that protect and grow the fund to benefit Alaskans today and for future generations. However, these are not normal times. Russia's aggressive invasion of a peaceful, sovereign, neighboring country and the monstrous attacks by Russian troops on Ukraine's civilians must be met with global responses. And these responses should include divesting of Russian assets. Otherwise, we are indirectly funding the Russian assault on Ukraine. Just because we're far away, we should not turn a blind eye to the daily Russian atrocities. It is appropriate for the legislature to take this action, even if it means a comparatively small loss for the fund. I encourage you to rely on the expertise found in the Permanent Fund Corporation and the Department of Revenue to ensure that this bill is well-crafted so that the actions can be taken swiftly and efficiently as soon as it takes effect. Thank you for this opportunity to testify.
And thank you, Ms. Mathias, for the testimony and apologies for the mispronunciation of your last name initially. I don't see anybody else online to testify, so I'm going to close public testimony for HB 396 at this time. Also available for questions, if anyone on the committee has questions, is Jim Parise, Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, Chris Pogue, with the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, I believe is general counsel or has a similar role, and then Pam Leary, Treasury Division Director for the Department of Revenue. Are there questions from the committee for this? Yes? Seeing none, I'm going to set an amendment deadline for HB 396 to be submitted to Legislative Legal Sunday at 5 p.m. and submitted to my office Monday at 5 p.m. So Legislative Legal Sunday, 5 p.m., my office Monday at 5 p.m., and we will set aside HB 396 at this time. Thank you, Ms. Borsoff. This takes us to the next item on today's agenda, House Bill 66. This is the fourth hearing for House Bill 66, and we have public testimony notice today. And previously mentioned, I might start with that sooner rather than later for those who may be online to testify. So I'm going to go ahead and open public testimony for House Bill 66. And it looks like we have Robert Welton and Douglas. If you can hear us, please go ahead, put yourself on record and present your testimony in three or fewer minutes.
Hello, my name is Robert Welton. I live in Douglas. I'm unaffiliated. I wanted to provide comments on HB 66 version 0. Broadly, the goal of the system should be to make things easy to vote and hard to cheat, and barriers to voting should only be raised if there's a verified need. HB 66 raises audit requirements, which is good, and expands early registration, which is also good. But there's two major problems I see with the bill. The first one is that it requires absentee voters to reapply if they haven't voted absentee over 4 years. There's no need to tighten this up. In testimony during the Senate, Senate State Affairs this spring, Director Fanumi and I testified that there was no fraud in the 2020 election. I don't remember the name of the other gentleman in the same session who pointed out that if you had fraudulent absentee votes, you would end up having an increase in the number of duplicate votes because those people would go into the poll and vote as well. Since there's not an increase in duplicate votes, it kind of mathematically proves there was not any fraud in absentee voting. So there's really no need to increase restrictions for this because there's by proof no fraud. The second problem with this absentee voting thing is that it likely violates federal elections law. Federal election law does not allow states to strike voters from the rolls just because they didn't vote. And I'd contend this probably violates that law. The second major problem that I see in this is that it requires mandatory signature verification on all absentee ballots. Now, right now, the division checks signatures if there's a suspicious ballot or something doesn't look right about it, which seems to work fine. Again, as mentioned above, there's no fraud in our electoral system, so there's really no need to tighten this up. And the second problem I see with this is that it opens the process up to partisan abuse. They did a similar law change in Texas this year, and after a recent election, about 30% of absentee ballots were rejected in some counties. So I could see a scenario here where Republicans question absentee ballots in Democratic precincts, and Democrats question absentee ballots in Republican districts to try and tilt the system in their favor. And this is opening us up to an abuse that I think is a very bad idea. And like I said before, there's no fraud that would require us to tighten this up. It has not been a problem. I don't have time to go into more detail on the bill, so I just really want to thank you all for taking the time to listen to me. And whether we agree or disagree, everyone on the committee, I want to thank you for your service to the state. I know this is a big time commitment, probably a money commitment for a lot of you. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Welton, for your testimony. I'm going to take a brief at ease. Going back on the record, thank you, Mr. Welton, for your testimony. I don't see anybody else available online. I don't think there's anybody in the room to testify, so I'm going to close public testimony for HB 66. So this takes the bill back before us, and we have staff for the sponsor, Mr. Mike Mason, in the room. I also, for the committee's reference, and want to please come forward, Mr. Mason, let the committee know that we have the coterie of experts from the previous hearing available, including Hillary Hall with the National Voter Home Institute, Noah Klein from Legislative Legal, Tom Flynn from the Department of Law, Michaela Thompson, Operations Manager for the Division of Elections. And then also in the room, per request, is Casey Schroeder with the Department of Law Criminal Division, given questions that surfaced in the previous hearing about how concerns about criminality or fraud are handled. Mr. Mason, any comments you'd like to make before we open it up for committee questions?
Mike Mason, staff to Representative Chris Tuck, through the chair. Just to respond to the public comment, the gentleman made a very good point. The change to the permanent absentee voting system that he was talking about was a change that was made in the other body. The current version that we have, CS4 HB 66 version O, it would give Alaskans the option to receive absentee ballots by mail for all future state elections without having to fill out an application every year. Right now, voters must fill out a formal application every year. Currently, Alaska does have a permanent absentee voting list, but it's authorized by regulation, not statute. And the current list basically serves those who live in very rural areas, the disabled, or persons who live in places like senior homes. The change that the gentleman was talking about aligns with what was made in the Senate, and that is in alignment with the provisions in Governor Dunleavy's bill that would allow voters to request absentee ballots for 4 years. Voters would be required to resubmit their request after that four-year period. That's the only thing I would like to clarify.
Thank you, Mr. Mason. Let's see. Well, we can open it up to committee questions. Are there questions for Mr. Mason? Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair Christ-Tompkins, and welcome, Mr. Mason. Thank you. Could you clarify the rationale behind why every 4 years they would like people to have to say they'd like to vote absentee again?
That might be a better addressed to the senator, Senator Schauer, and the governor, but I can try. So our version, we believe that absentee voters should, if they want to, should always be able to receive an absentee ballot without having to make that formal request every year. The thought is that with the four-year time frame is that it would basically just put a limit on it as opposed to in perpetuity. So basically every 4 years, every two election cycles, you could sign up one more time. As I said, our current version of the bill does not include that four-year time frame.
Thank you. Another follow-up, if I might.
Representative Story.
Thank you. Yeah, I was just listening to the invited testimony, and I couldn't find in the bill exactly where the gentleman was concerned that this bill might violate federal law. Do you have a response to that?
I think he was talking about where you would be removed from the list after that four-year time frame, and in our version, version O that is before you, that is not the case. So I think he was just a little – he was reading into what the action that would happen in the Senate.
Follow up. So that does not violate federal law?
I think if you arbitrarily, for no reason, remove someone from a list, but that is not the case in this bill.
Thank you for clarifying that.
Thank you. Further questions for Mr. Mason? Thank you. And I want to specifically open it up for questions for Ms. Schroeder from the Department of Law on effectively what happens when there's instances of possible criminal behavior? What is the norm right now? Are there questions from the committee on that subject? Specifically looking to the member who had such questions in the previous hearing. But maybe those questions no longer exist, Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess, Ms. Schroeder, if you're able, because it came up the other day in the conversation about the risk-limiting audits, and there was a series of questions that, as I understand it, were unrelated to the audit, but were more related to someone potentially being a fraudulent voter, like trying to think of even what some of the examples were in terms of, you know, bringing, trying to vote more than once, or, the case that you can't discuss the details of because it's ongoing, but what we know because it's been publicly reported related to, you know, multiple ballots from that address. So I guess if you could just describe, you know, because I want to sort of like separate, have a bright line between the two phases of the process, you know, of what happens prior to voting or as you're trying to vote. You know, that kind of fraud versus the folks who are concerned about fraudulent results.
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, as far as the criminal aspects go, there are different criminal offenses that focus on fraudulently applying to vote, signing a petition when you know that you're not a qualified voter, those types of activities that focus on activities that occur before the actual vote happens. And then there is separate sets of crimes that focus on a person intentionally voting with the intent to affect the outcome of the election, and they're voting more than once, and they intend for their ballot to be counted more than once. And I think that that's an important distinction and an important element of the offense, because I think sometimes you may have people that vote more than once, but they forgot, like they voted, you know, previously they forgot that they did, but they voted again. And so it's that intent for both ballots to be counted that makes it a criminal offense.
Thank you.
Other questions from the committee? And just for committee's reference, several times there were questions raised to ongoing cases, State v. Ledoux and State v. Bell. And it's my understanding from the Department of Law that because both cases are ongoing, neither the civil nor criminal divisions can't comment on them further or in detail for, I think, obvious reasons. Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. Now, the bill references potentially being guilty of perjury. I'm just wondering, what are the elements to perjury?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, the elements of perjury are that someone knowingly makes a sworn statement, and a sworn statement can be a couple of things, but in this case, I think we're talking about somebody who's been warned that they may do something under penalty of perjury. The statement was false, and the defendant did not believe the sworn statement to be true. So those are the three elements we have to prove for perjury.
Thank you, Paula.
And
to be sworn, you don't have to raise your right hand. You can just sign your name. Is that correct?
That's correct. Through the chair, there is a specific definition of sworn statements. Sworn statement means a statement knowingly given under oath or affirmation attesting to the truth of what is stated, including a notarized statement, or a statement knowingly given under penalty of perjury under AS 09-63-020. And I think with the elections offenses, that's mostly what we're talking about there.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Additional questions? I might surface a scenario that came up in the previous hearing, which is, let's say a citizen observes something that looks suspiciously fraudulent or criminal or whatever. I think the anecdotal instance that was cited was someone who came in to vote with someone else's form of identification. And it was very sort of apparent that, or the person openly admitted that they were trying to use someone else's identification. So I'm a citizen. I observe that going down in my Sitka precinct, and I'm concerned. What is the sort of process for referral or intake for criminal division? If I report that to the Division of Elections, I think Ms. Thompson said that the Division of Elections would ultimately elevate it to the criminal division. What happens when in reported instance like that reaches your agency?
Chair Christ-Tompkins, first we would want the citizen to say something. If you see something, say something. Under this hypothetical, it appears that they would have probably reported it to the Division of Elections. The Division of Elections, we would assume, would look into it, see some sort of irregularity that they thought rose to the level of a criminal offense, and then they would compile the evidence that they had gathered, potentially along with law enforcement, and then forward up a case to us. And then we would screen that case as we would screen any other criminal case. We have to make sure that we can meet the elements of the offense and prove that beyond a reasonable doubt. So we would see what evidence that we had and whether or not there was enough evidence to prove the elements beyond a reasonable doubt.
And just speaking roughly to the extent that you have knowledge, how many referrals has criminal division received for such suspicious instances where a citizen has seen something and saying something, either in recent years or really even in recent decades?
Chair Christ-Tompkins, I did actually, I was actually able to pull some of that data, and I looked at all of the offenses under 1556, and in the entire history of the criminal division, we have had 10. I can't speak to things that we've closed out. These are prosecutions that we've accepted, and of the 10, 5 are closed and 5 are open.
Thank you. Representative Eastman.
Thanks to the chair. And since we're talking a long period of time here, I don't expect any privacy is going to be implicated. But of those 10 cases, can you specify how many of them came from or through the division?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I don't know. I would suspect that the division was involved in all of them. The Division of Elections may have been more information to that question, though.
Thank you.
Other questions from the committee? I want to respect Ms. Schroeder's time, so I'd really encourage if we have questions about sort of how potential criminal election conduct is handled by the state, now would be the time. I know she's very generous in making herself available, so we could bring her back again. But Representative Eastman.
Thank you. I heard conversation that there was some legislation being considered that might facilitate the department being able to prosecute election-related offenses. What might be lacking currently in statute that would allow for the effective, you know, prosecution of election-related offenses, if anything?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I don't think that I'm aware of anything that the criminal division has requested. Obviously, the policymakers can make changes to the criminal code how they see fit. I think that the laws we have on the books as far as criminal conduct under 1556 are pretty robust. And I have not heard any complaints from any of the prosecutors that handle these cases as far as they're not being enough or I have to screen this out because it should be a crime, but it's not a crime.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much, Ms. Schroeder, for being available. And if further questions arise, I'm sure we'll be in touch. But, Representative Eastman.
Just one. I'm sorry to get you in, but since you are here, what sort of statute of limitations would apply to prosecutions under this title, or particularly relating to the election-related offenses?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, most of the offenses under 1556 are Class C felonies or misdemeanors, and under the statute of limitations statute under 1210.010, the statute of limitations would be 5 years, because the longer statute of limitations has specific offenses that are listed out, and elections statutes are not in there.
Follow up. And when does that 5-year clock start ticking?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, when we become aware of the offense.
Okay, thank you.
Seeing no further questions, Ms. Schroeder, I think you're free to go. Thank you again for being here.
Thank you.
And I think we will set aside House Bill 66, having conducted public testimony. I think for the committee's reference, I'm hoping to take up amendments for this legislation next week. So, yes, Representative Kleinman.
We set a deadline for amendments already? I apologize if my memory is not
tracking. We have not. So on Tuesday, my hope and intent is that we can double-click on the open-source voting provisions that are in the CS per previous committee questions, and we're lining up testifiers accordingly, and other sort of at-large questions. I mean, I'm going to speak conditionally, so don't take this to the bank. I want to robustly proviso this, but potentially set an amendment deadline thereafter. So I just say, if you're thinking about amendments, might as well start work now. But I just want to make sure that we have the opportunity to get those additional experts on the record before we dive in. Great. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Mason. We'll set HB 66 aside, and we'll move on to HB 316. And per the sponsor's request, we're just going to take public testimony on the legislation today, and then we'll take it up for final consideration next week. And I'll just note that there were no amendments submitted by the deadline. So for HB 316, I'm going to open public testimony. I don't think there's anybody in the room to testify. I don't see anybody online to testify. So we're going to close public testimony, and that sets us up next week for final passage, although Representative Kaufman is here. So I'm going to take a brief at ease. We're back on the record, and actually I think there was question whether Representative Kaufman with travel would be able to be here today, but he is, at least for a few more minutes, so may entertain any final comments on HB 316 before entertaining a motion. Representative Kaufman, any comments?
Thank you. I'm sorry. So are there any questions on it?
I don't think so.
I guess I just wanted to mention through the chair that we did get that revised fiscal note, so it's greatly reduced. So all that we hope for. So we've got that. So if there was any questions about the fiscal note. I move 316 out of committee.
Absolutely. And just what version number, just to
I'm
be
sorry.
Precise.
Yeah. You caught me by surprise here.
No. We're just.
Sure, I'm happy to make the motion.
I expected that you want to get rid of it that badly.
No, I just, it's our custom that the that vice chair.
Yes, sir.
Let's lateral it over to Rep. Kleinman.
I appreciate that. I was not expecting to be here at this point, so thank you very much.
Right. Is it version A we're on?
It's committee substitute.
B.
Version B.
I believe it's
brief at ease.
Report House Bill 316, version 32LS1076 / B out of committee with individual recommendations in the accompanying fiscal notes. The committee gives legal services the authority to make technical and conforming changes.
And seeing and hearing no objection, House Bill 316 moves from committee, and we'll circulate the paperwork as we go. And Rep. Kaufman, a nice little thing before you have to take off. Thanks for being with us.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. And I'm going to try and stick around to sign the paperwork.
Okay. That seems appropriate.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Kaufman. This takes us to Senate Bill 161. And just for the committee's Well, actually, brief at ease. Back on the record, we're on making good progress here. Fourth item out of six on today's agenda, SB 161. This is a second hearing. This is Senator Wielichowski's legislation, who's with us here in the room, as well as Mr. Dunsmore, staff to Senator Wielichowski. There's public testimony noticed today, so I'm going to start with that, and then we'll dive into the six amendments we received by the amendment deadline. I'm going to open public testimony. I don't believe anybody in the room is here to testify. I don't see anybody online, so we'll close public testimony. And Senator Wielkowski, Mr. Dinsmore, if you want to make any comments, you're welcome to, and we'll likely call on you for your perspective on amendments as well, but if you just have any at-large comments, please go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Bill Wielkowski, State Senator representing East Anchorage and Jay Bear, and appreciate the committee taking up this again. And I don't have any additional comments on the bill. It's a fairly straightforward bill. It was brought to me by a constituent in the district who's, as I mentioned, was active in the Libertarian Party, and a pretty straightforward bill. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any at-large questions from the committee for SB 161? Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Just for context, was the bill conceived of before or after ballot measure 2 was passed?
Representative Eastman, through the chair, I'm trying to remember the exact date I got the phone call. Do you remember? Do you recall, David?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, for the record, this is David Dunsmore, staff to Senator Wielkowski. I believe we were approached in December of 2021 by a constituent asking the senator to consider introducing this bill. So that would be after ballot measure 2 had passed.
Yeah, thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Seeing none, we'll go to amendments, and we have six amendments that were submitted all by Representative Eastman, and I have them in order that I assume may have been requested by Representative Eastman. B.2 is the first amendment, so we'll take up amendment number 1, Representative Eastman.
Great. I'll move amendment B.2.
Checked.
There's an objection, Representative Eastman.
Great. And I don't. Most of these are not incredibly sophisticated amendments, so you'd probably be able to go through these pretty quick, I would imagine. So this amendment deals with a date on which the division would calculate the number of voters for calculating whether or not a party or a group has reached party status. The relevant language you can find on page 1, line 13, sets that date at January 1st of that year. So if on January 1st that party has reached the cutoff, then they would be considered a party for that year. And then you can find the reference to the decennial federal census in 2030 would no longer be relevant since it would be calculated as of January 1st of each year.
Thank you, Representative Eastman. Questions for the sponsor of Amendment Number 1? Senator Wielkowski, any comment on Amendment Number 1?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I learned a long time ago when you file a bill and it becomes the possession of the body and it's no longer in the Senate, and it's up to the committee to do what it will do. I guess just sort of a general statement. You know, when we filed it was a simple one line bill. It grew to a few more lines in the State Affairs Committee on the Senate side, and that was the committee's will. Quite frankly, over you know, something that I didn't necessarily support, but I'll go with, you know, whatever this committee decides, I'm happy with. I guess my preference would be that if you know, it's a simple bill and just keep it the way it is. And if there are other issues that people want to file other bills on, then they're certainly welcome to do that. But so my preference would be to just keep the bill the way it is. But I understand that it's the committee's prerogative. And but my preference would be to just leave the bill the way it is, Mr. Chairman.
Other questions for the sponsor of Amendment Number 1? Seeing none, Representative Klayman, do you maintain your objection?
I do.
Any closing comments, Representative Eastman?
Thank you. Yeah, I think January 1st seems to be the logical place to sort of set the benchmark. If we have January 1st as the trigger, then I think that's something that all voters and party officials and the division can understand, and I think it would limit confusion. I think the reference to the 2030 census is another way of doing it, and I think this is just more straightforward, streamlined. So with that, I'll let you call for the vote.
Thank you, Representative Eastman. Will the clerk please call the roll on passage of Amendment Number 1?
Representative Tarr?
No.
Representative Story?
No.
Representative Klayman?
No.
Representative Eastman?
Yes.
Chairperson Tompkins?
No.
One yay, four nays.
By a vote of one yay and four nays, Amendment Number 1, B.2, is not adopted, and that takes us to Amendment Number 2, Representative Eastman.
Thank you. I'll move Amendment B.3.
Object.
There's an objection, Representative Eastman.
Thank you. You happen to know that this amendment will make the bill shorter a little bit, and this is going to limit the number of members required from 5,000 down to 250. There are not a terrible number of groups trying to become parties in this state. I don't think there's really ever been a very large number competing all at the same time. You know, the particular groups' names change from year to year, but there's not a ton. And I think even with just 250 people, there's unlikely to be an overabundance of new political parties forming. So I think it makes it easier for parties to start and get that lowest rung of the ladder. And I think it can only increase the freedom and opportunity the voters have.
Senator Wielichowski, any comment?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. The comment I made in the initial amendment, I think, goes through to all these, and that we our preference would be to keep the bill the way it is. I would mention that second provision actually is something that the deletion, that's the way I originally had the bill written, and that was changed in the Senate. So I'd be reluctant to go and unchange something that was done by the Senate. And on adjusting the number from 5,000 to 250, there are some privileges that are associated with having being a political party, and I do think 250 is on the low end, and so that's a concern for me, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Klayman?
Question actually for the bill sponsor. So at least as originally introduced in the Senate, it was basically 5,000, and there was no, what shall we call, a decennial population adjustment provision, and the additional was to make it a population adjustment provision. That's the only real change that came from the original bill?
That's correct, yes. Okay. Through the chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And is the objection still maintained?
Yes.
Closing comments, Representative Eastman.
With that, I will speed things along and withdraw that particular amendment.
Okay, Amendment Number 2, B.3 is withdrawn, taking us to Amendment Number 3, Representative Eastman.
Thank you, and I'll move B.6.
Object.
Objection, Representative Eastman.
Thank you. This this whole idea of defining political party based on voters, my impression is that it kind of goes back to a previous way that we dealt with parties and elections before the passage of Ballot Measure 2. I think the bill, you know, had bills like this, I know, have come up over the years, or the ideas have, and that was all under the regime before Ballot Measure 2 passed. Now that there is no claim of exclusivity for ballot access by a party, I think it's very less of a drive and less reward, but less reward for becoming a political party, because all candidates, you know, have access to the ballot. and effectively now no parties do, because it's the candidate, not the party, that is filing to gain access in the general election. So recognizing that, Amendment Number 3 creates an opportunity for voters to have a confidential party affiliation, which would only become public or would no longer be confidential at the point that a particular group became large enough to become a political party.
Thank you, Senator Wielichowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate the intent here. I do think there's already an option that exists under our current law. And if a person does not wish to declare a political party, they can simply declare themselves as undeclared. And we've seen that with major political candidates in this body, political candidates running for governor or other bodies. So I think that already exists. And I would be concerned that there would be expense exposed to this, just for the division in terms of trying to figure out if a group has enough numbers to meet the requirement of being a political party. So, yeah, this concerns me, Mr. Chairman.
Is there other questions or comments for Representative Eastman? Or was that going to be a wrap-up
seeing
comment?
No questions, I'll withdraw that amendment. And the idea is now on the table for people to do with as they will.
Yeah, I just make the comment, the prolificness of ideation continues to amaze me. Representative Eastman, Amendment Number 4.
Thank you. I'll move Amendment B dot 1. Object. Thank you. B dot 1 also would effectively make the statute shorter. And there's language currently in the statute that these 500 voters need to represent a political program, and I think that language might be a little bit archaic. I don't know that all 500 voters necessarily would sign on to exactly the same political program or even know that there was a particular political program. I think the idea, for all said purposes, is that you have a party, it has a name, people know what that party is. That party might change its political program year to year or even during an election cycle. And so I just suggest that for making the statute more effective and actually recognizing that it's not a political program, whatever that is, but it's actually the party itself and the number of voters that we're talking about that's most important.
Senator Wielichowski.
I'm going to turn to my staff on this one, Mr. Chair, if I could.
Mr. Dunsmore.
Mr. Chairman, again, David Dunsmore for the record. This one, in reviewing this amendment, we weren't clear what practical effect it would have, because I don't believe the Division of Elections conducts a review to determine whether a party has a political program. It's just kind of assumed definitionally that if you were a group that is seeking party access, that means you have a political program. So I think in reviewing this amendment, we came out of the fact that we're not sure whether it would actually functionally change how the statute works.
I should note for the committee's reference, we have Tom Flynn still online with the Department of Law. And I might ask Mr. Flynn, what is the effect of this language and statute representing a political program?
Chair Christ-Tompkins, I am listening in, but I'm going to need a little more direction on the section we're looking at just so I can get up to speed.
Yes. So we're looking at Amendment Number 4, which maybe a little counterintuitively is Work Order Number B.1, and it refers to page 1, line 6 of version B of Senate Bill 161, and specifically the language represents a political program. Basically this amendment deletes that language, and I think the question at hand, at least my question, is does that language represent a political program have any sort of force of law or substance or anything like that?
Yes, Chair Kreis-Tompkins. So, no, I don't think the Division of Elections is in the business of deciding what a political program is or isn't and you know, denying political party status on those grounds. So I don't think that has a large practical effect, no.
Thank you. In other words, this might just sort of economize the statutory language and this sort of political program language might be, you know, vestigial to goodness knows when.
That's my sense, Chair Kreis-Tompkins, yes.
Okay, thank you. Representative Klayman.
Oh, I think this is a question for the attorney from the AG's office. It's kind of a chicken or the egg question. If you've got a group of people who want to call themselves the Liberty Party, I'm choosing something that I don't think is a party today. They want to call themselves the Liberty Party, but they only have 4,000 people members of the Liberty Party under this bill, regardless of whatever their party platform is. They don't become identified as a party until they get to 5,000. Do I track that correctly?
Through the chair to Representative Klayman, yes, I believe that's correct. Yeah, under this bill, they'd have to clear that 5,000-person threshold.
And so if you deleted the language represents a political program, the division would primarily be looking for an organized group of voters, and that might either be a group of voters that called themselves the Liberty Party, or it could be Alaskans United for Smaller Dividends. And that also could be as long as the division found they were organized around something, regardless of, not without saying anything about a political program, in either of those cases, if the division found a basis to find that they were organized around some topic or another, and they were all, presumably all voters, then they could be recognized as a party.
Through the chair, Representative Klayman, I believe that either of those would qualify as a political party. Yes, I'm struggling right now to imagine a situation where the division would look at two groups, both with more than 500,000 or 5,000 voters, and say this one has a political program and this one doesn't. That seems like it would present all sorts of potential problems.
Follow up. But at some level, they'd have to meet some finding that there was some way to figure out that the group, such as they are, had some enough of a commonality of interest to call them an organized group.
Through the chair, Representative Klayman, yes, I suppose so.
Okay. That's all I have. Thank you.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess what I'm wondering and what seems like it could be problematic is that if you have two groups of 5,000 people that want to establish themselves as a political party, but they're both, you know, Alaskans United for Smaller Dividends, it would seem to me that the requirement for a political program would be so that the division could differentiate between the missions of these two respective groups, because otherwise the potential exists for multiple political parties that I guess represent the same thing. I mean that has the potential, you know, any group of 5,000 people then can have the same exact mission, the same purpose, and could become a political party. So it seems to me you wouldn't want that, and that having this represents a political program would be a way to differentiate the values or mission of that particular group.
Is that a question for Mr. Flynn?
Yeah, like, you know, how would you consider this particular circumstance? I guess to me, in thinking about it, that's the place where it would feel problematic, because, you know, you don't want to have five groups that are all essentially the same purpose, or do we? I guess that's the question I have, is, you know, what about the circumstance of two similarly identified groups?
Mr. Flynn, and then we'll also go to the amendment sponsor.
Yes, through the chair to Representative Tarr. I think that's frankly a danger inherent in the system. I mean, people have political association rights. I don't believe that groups submit their political program to the Division of Elections for approval or not approval. So I think there exists even today the danger of duplicate groups and arguments that one group is overlapping on the other. And I think those just become political questions rather than questions for the division to sort out.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And yes, we have had groups with very similar sounding names that have all been available on the list of things you can register with. There's been a Republican Party, of course, and there's been a Reform Republican Party for a number of years. That was an option, as well as the regular Republican Party. There's other examples we can probably cite. But the mechanism of figuring out what the party stands for is that's not – the division never touches that. I mean, you have a list that they put together. If you want to form a group, you come up with a name. You file your paperwork. Goes to the division. Now you're on the list that you can register as a voter with that party. And that's the mechanism of organization. So we have in the statute an organized group of voters. How are they organized? They're organized because somebody, in this case 5,000 somebodies, marked on their voter registration that they wanted to be associated with that group. And now they are organized according to the law. But there's no place on that voter registration form to say differences between particular parties. It would also not be possible to have two groups with the same name, because then there would be no way of differentiating them. And so you can have very similar sounding, you know, names, of course, but there's only on the form ever going to be an opportunity for you to register for one, you know, party with a particular name. There might be a lot of different parties, but they all have to have different names.
Representative Clayman.
I think the question raised by Representative Tarr was actually a really good question, and kind of to phrase the question a little bit differently, if you had Anchorage voters for a smaller dividend and they had – it's changing the circumstances a little bit. If you had Anchorage voters for a smaller dividend and they were 4,000, and you also had Fairbanks voters for a smaller dividend and they too had 4,000, they're left with the choice of saying, well, should we call the other city and see if we should get together because we have a common purpose. And if we got our 4,000 together times two, we now have the 5,000 to be a party. But if we insist that Anchorage and Fairbanks are meaningfully different for these purposes, then neither group would register. But at some point, it forces the question for groups that are trying to reach the threshold, how do they get enough people to identify with the same thing, whatever that name may be. But to keep move the ball forward, I will withdraw my objection to Amendment Number 4.
Is there further objection to Amendment Number 4? Seeing and hearing none, Amendment Number 4 is adopted. That takes us to Amendment Number 5, Representative Eastman.
Thank you, and I will move Amendment B.4.
Check. Amendment Number 5, B.4, has been objected to, Representative Eastman.
Yes, and so this amendment, which end up when you write it out, ends up being quite long, though that wasn't the idea. So the pertinent language is going to be Section 3, and that is let's start with Section 2. So Section 2 is new language, a voter registration agency, which we talked about in our previous hearing. Shall provide each applicant for registration or re-registration the opportunity to adopt a political party or group affiliation. The voter registration agency shall provide each applicant a complete list of political parties and political groups in the state. Now, the reason that that's important, and it's kind of a surprise that that's not already in statute, I think most people assume that it is that it's not necessarily required right now that you give people that opportunity to register with a political party when you register to vote. Of course, there's no requirement to affiliate with a party, and this amendment wouldn't change that. It would still be your option to have no association or to associate with a particular party. But For example, if you, you know, are registering to vote through a PFD application, you may never know what the parties are that you could register with. And so that's not even a part of that process. At least last time I visited the website, it wasn't part of that process. So this would make sure that you at least have that opportunity when you're registering to vote, because it would require that a voter registration agency at least provide you that information.
Senator Wielkowski, any comment?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think one concern is just the provision on applying for dividends. And when you apply for a dividend, there's, as you know, automatic voter registration. It automatically registers you, as my understanding, undeclared. And this would require the addition of political parties on that sheet. And political groups, it could be rather lengthy. It's already a small paper form's already fairly small, and it's just going to add a lot more information to that. When, if a person's really interested in declaring a party, they can simply go online and register for a party. So I that's a concern that we would have, Mr. Chairman.
Questions from the committee? Representative Eastman.
And I guess I would just wonder if the sponsor has any particular feedback or thoughts. But currently, you know, there's big name parties and everybody kind of knows who those are. Most people do. But for parties that are trying to start or trying to reach that 5,000 vote threshold or voter threshold, it's a little bit harder for those folks to get the word out about who they are and, you know, register with us. And so it would seem to me that when we omit that list or automatically, you know, register people as undeclared, that we're benefiting the bigger, larger, well-known parties at the expense of others competing. I just wonder if you had any thoughts.
I don't really have any additional thoughts. It's, you know, I don't know if it's the state's obligation to promote political parties or even let people know which political parties are out there. If people are interested in a political party, they can go online and do the research. The PFD section of the law registers you undeclared, and if someone's interested in going and researching which political party they want to be a part of or declaring it, they're certainly welcome to do that. And, you know, it might be a good topic for a separate piece of legislation.
And Representative Eastman, through the chair, one thing in reviewing this, I mean, from a perspective of legislative staff, where, you know, we often, as you know, all of our offices often have to assist constituents who, you know, may have had issues, and often as we're, you know, with, and so we looked at, looked at the, you know, a physical application for a permanent fund dividend. This is, they didn't have the regular PDF online, but this is the application for a disabled adult. See, it's two pages, relatively small print. So there's already, you know, the option, you know, the options for people to make a mistake on the form that may impact their ability to get a dividend and may end up having us call a legislative office to try. And sometimes we can't. Sometimes those mistakes are fatal. And so it seems like it would be an issue if we add on here the field where we'd have to add, currently there's 11 political parties and groups seeking recognition, plus there's the option for nonpartisan and declares. So you'd have to add a field with at least 13 options. And so that the form, you know, at least for the paper form, that might cause an undue burden for the, you know, that is greater outweighs the issue you're trying to address there.
Any wrap-up comments, Representative Eastman?
Yeah, for the record and for clarification, so if you're a new resident to Alaska and you're a Democrat because you came from another state and you were registered as a Democrat in that other state and you consider yourself a Democrat and you come to Alaska, you're registering to vote through the PFD application, because it's got a lot of voter registration aspects to that, and it's telling you you're going to be registered to vote. And so you register to vote through that option, and then you find out, you know, after the fact, because it didn't really tell you up front, that now you're registered undeclared, but you consider yourself a Democrat because you've always been a Democrat, and if you ever had the option, you've always chosen, you know, Democrat. It just seems to me that we might be doing people a disservice by not allowing them that opportunity as part of our voter registration process. But I put the idea on the table, so I will withdraw the amendment.
Amendment number 5 is withdrawn. Takes us to amendment number 6, B.5, Representative Eastman.
Thank you. I will move B.5.
Object.
There's an objection, Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And, you know, one of the concerns that was raised earlier was, you know, if you've got this Fairbanks smaller dividend party and Anchorage smaller dividend party, how do we fix that if that is a problem and people want to get together? And, you know, there has been in history, and I don't know to what extent that is, that specific problem has ever surfaced. I don't know that it has in this state, but it can be quite difficult for those groups, especially groups that are starting out trying to reach that threshold, whether it's 5,000 or we come up with a different number, to reorient and change their name and whatnot. And this would just make it clear that, you know, we're not trying to make that unnecessarily burdensome, so that if you are competing to become a political party, or you're a political party already and you choose, you know, through your party process to change or improve upon the name, that you're not going to get penalized for doing so.
Senator Wielichowski, any comment on amendment number 6?
This seems like a somewhat of a substantive issue that probably be worthy of its own bill, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions or comments from committee? Representative Tarr?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess just similar to what the bill sponsor said, I mean, this, I think, you know, very sort of minor, you know, in terms of what the statute is being changed to do, it feels like it would be good to give this a chance, you know, and then we could come back and review if there are, you know, dozens of new parties and, you know, these kind of challenging situations with changing party names, you know, then that would be the time for review and just keep it to the more limited change that's under consideration today.
Any closing comments, Representative Eastman?
No, I will withdraw the amendment. Thank you.
Okay, and amendment number 6 is withdrawn. So that takes us back to the bill before us, SB 161, as amended. Are there any lingering questions from committee members? I don't see any. Any closing comments? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just quickly, I do appreciate the bill because I think there's a diversity of views among Alaskans that are not well represented by just a few parties. So I think having more options, you know, hopefully will engage more people in our electoral and policymaking process. Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no other. Oh, Representative Eastman.
Yeah, I will just say I applaud the sponsor for bringing the bill forward. I don't think that relaxing restrictions, I think this is a relaxing of the restrictions. I don't think that that is in any way a bad thing. And I think we could probably take a few more steps in that direction just to make it more of an equal playing field. And I think ballot measure 2 did some of that. So there's, you know, pros and cons to that. So I appreciate the bill. Thank you.
Representative Klayman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move to report SB 161, version 32, LS 1361/B, as amended, out of committee with individual recommendations and the accompanying fiscal notes. The committee gives legal services the authority to make technical and conforming changes.
Seeing and hearing no objection, SB 161 moves from committee. And thank you so much, Senator Wielichowski and Mr. Dunsmore, for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That takes us to the fifth item out of six on today's agenda. This is HB 256 from Representative Carr. And we have public testimony notice, and I'm just going to dive right in for anyone who might be online so they don't need to wait if they have other things to do beyond listen to our committee. So I'm going to open public testimony for HB 256. And online, I see Philip Mosier and Juno. If you can hear us, please go ahead, put yourself on record, and present your testimony in three or fewer minutes.
Yes, hello. My name is Philip Mosier. I live in Juneau, Alaska, and I'm representing myself. I'm calling in support of the passage of 256. I believe it provides an important measure to gather and create a centralized database of police use of force from the state of Alaska. I don't have a lot of confidence in it being in the hands of the FBI as a database. I believe this measure should include a publicly accessible database. I'm not particularly excited about it going to an organization that only recently divulged that they withheld information that would have freed several people that were accused of the assassination of Malcolm X. However, I do think this is important. I think providing this information in a database is important, and it will be down the line. I'd also like to call in objection to this measure as a conflict of interest to a certain member of the committee. Since this bill pertains to a relationship between the police and the FBI, having a member of a group that's against support for the leaders of that organization in a plot to obstruct a federal election, and that we're on record and are being investigated by the FBI for plotting to kidnap and potentially do violence to political members and legislators such as yourselves. I don't think that's right. And I think having a member of an organization that's seeking to create that political party as a legitimate group that could potentially have 5,000 or more members in Alaska, not saying that based off of any facts except for the committee member's own statements, and that might be seeking to get legitimacy to that group as a political movement in Alaska, I do not think this will receive a fair hearing in this committee. However, I do urge the passage of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for that testimony. Moving next in the queue, we also have Helen Marie Mattesi. Apologies for any mispronunciation in Fairbanks. If you can hear us, please go ahead, put yourself on record, and present your testimony in three or fewer minutes.
Good afternoon. I thank you for the opportunity to quickly give my opinion. I support the bill. Any steps towards accountability, I believe, protects our citizens. It's simply good housekeeping. It can eliminate an officer's simply relocating if he has a bad record and carrying on with the kinds of things that are not good for our community. All lethal force and misconduct should be recorded. It should be public record. We should all know about it. And I support the bill. Thank you very much for allowing me to testify today.
Thank you very much for taking the time to testify. I don't see anyone else online to testify on HB 256, and I don't believe anybody is in the room to testify. So at this time, I'm going to close public testimony for HB 256. There was an amendment deadline for this legislation. No amendments were submitted by the deadline, so that takes us to the bill as a whole. Are there any questions from the committee for the sponsor or sponsor staff? Representative Klayman.
Actually, it's not a question for the sponsor or the sponsor staff, but I see Ms. Good is here. I have a question for Ms. Good.
Ms. Good, welcome.
Ms. Good, it's my general understanding through the chair that this bill codifies the existing practice. Can you comment on that and whether the department has a position on the bill?
Through the chair, for the record, Kelly Good, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Corrections, Representative Klingman, it pretty much codifies. So I did make it clear last week, and I think maybe you were on the phone, that there are a couple of communities that don't currently go through the DOC Municipal Academy training, but the sponsor has put in a two-year provision to allow them to do that. They do have training dollars that come through community jail funding, so we believe that that will just bring them all under the same training umbrella, and the timeline should give them plenty of time to be able to do that.
Thank you.
Other questions for the sponsor staff, Ms. Good, and also Lisa Perrington with DPS is online as well. Closing comments on House Bill 256, Representative Story.
Yes, I appreciate the intent and that this will be codified in law, so I support this bill.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And, you know, we had a bill that we dealt with previously dealing with the number of reports that we require in statutes, and we require an awful lot of reports. I'm a little bit hesitant to pass a bill that's going to require additional reports. I think Section 8 requires additional reports that are to be delivered to the House of Representatives and to the Senate. And I'm just wondering if we can't just make that information publicly available and you can go find it on the website rather than having people send us more reports.
Any other closing comments? Representative Tarr, as sponsor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the comments of the last few people. And to the last comment, you know, I think, again, these are things that could be revisited because the idea right now is that, you know, we're trying to learn more, right? And so we're collecting the data. You know, we want to be informed before we make any policy decisions. You know, this will ensure we receive that. But, you know, I'm not a fan of just paperwork shuffling around. So, you know, that I hope is a provision that if we're able to get this legislation through could be revisited and, you know, perhaps there'll be a date in the future where that's not necessary because we've kind of completed the work related to that. But I think that's a very fair consideration. Thank you.
Representative Klingman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move to report House Bill 256, version 32LS1341, /I, out of committee with individual recommendations and the accompanying fiscal notes. The committee gives legal services the authority to make technical and conforming changes.
Seeing and hearing no objection, the motion to discharge HB 256 passes. We'll circulate the paperwork as we go. And we'll move on to the sixth of six items on today's agenda. Welcome, Senator Begich, as well as, yes, staff to Senator Begich, Mercedes Colbert. And this is a first hearing for SB 66. Although the subject matter is not foreign to the committee from House companion legislation from my office, but the floor is yours, Senator Begich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Senator Tom Begich. I represent District J in Anchorage and serve as the minority leader in the State Senate. With me is my Chief of Staff, Mercedes Colbert, who's been carrying this legislation with me. For those who aren't familiar with the bill, which I'm certain that you are, with the content, as the Chairman just mentioned, SB 66 is simply a bill that updates the membership statutes for Legislative Council and the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, which are tasked, as you know, with the central roles of conducting internal business for the legislature throughout the year. Currently, under AS 2420, these committees must have, quote, at least one member from each of the two major political parties of each house, end quote, appointed to them. However, this the Senate branch of government and to some extent even the House branch of government has a history of coalition caucuses and unaffiliated legislators. In fact, in your majority caucus, there are four unaffiliated legislators already. And now, after the voter initiative in 2020, as was pointed out in earlier testimony on other legislation, those elected to these offices are not required to name a party affiliation. What Senate Bill 66 simply seeks to do is to update those statutes to ensure that all caucuses have a seat at the table of these two essential committees. I'm moving away from my prepared remarks for a moment, Mr. Chairman, just to point out that this year alone, we've dealt with issues related to COVID mitigation, the purchase of the Assembly office building, subpoenas filed in the matter of potential subpoenas and an investigation in the matter of the firing of the manager of our largest asset. All of these are items that my caucus had no vote on, no support, no ability to comment on, because we literally had no vote. I was privileged to have 1 year on Legislative Council in 2020, where my single voice was actually listened to. I participated in decision making. That is the only time in a decade that a member of the Senate minority has had representation on Leg Council, and we have not had legislative representation on LBNA. We have some backup documentation for that, should you desire to see it. What Senate Bill 66 does is it ensures that on those committees, consistent with uniform rules, there will be actually minority caucus representation. It ought to be of concern to all of us, members of the majority today, served in minorities in the past in the House, members of the majority in the Senate have served in the minority in the House. All of this matters, and that is why this bill received a unanimous vote of support on the floor in the state Senate just a week and a half ago. And with that, I would just say there was one amendment made on the floor of the Senate proposed by a majority member to make consistent with Uniform Rule 1E membership proportional. I'm neutral on that amendment. I've voted for it, but can go either way on it. So with that, I'm glad to turn it over to Chief of Staff Colbert for a very quick, very brief sectional, and then open it for questions, if that's okay, Mr. Chairman.
Absolutely. Ms. Colbert.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. Mr. Chairman, this is Mercedes Colbert, staff to Senator Begich of Anchorage. And this is a sectional analysis for Senate Bill 66 before you, version A.A. So this includes that change that Senator Begich mentioned that happened on the Senate floor on April 12th, approximately. Section 1 amends Alaska Statute 24.20.020. This is the statute regarding a legislative council membership. This will include at least one member of the minority on the legislative council. It includes language from Uniform Rule 1E, that's roughly the first page of your Uniform Rule Book, to entitle minority caucus membership on the council that is proportional to their total House membership. Section 2 of the bill amends Alaska Statute 24.20.161. This is regarding Legislative Budget and Audit Committee membership. This is to include at least one member of the minority on the LBNA committee, and it conforms the language to change where it says chairman to chair. Section 3 of the bill adds a new section to AS 2420 to define minority as a group of members who have organized and elected a minority leader and who constitute at least 25% of the total House membership. This, as well as in, it aligns with what's already in uniform rules and in current practice as well.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Eastman.
Thank you, and I appreciate you bringing the topic forward. I think it's an important topic. On the first line of page 2, it says that the appointment or reappointment of members of the council must be made within 15 days after the convening of the first regular session of each legislature. And I know that you're not changing this in the bill, but what happens when that particular statute doesn't happen, as in the case of the House each of the last four years? That 15-day deadline has come and gone, and no one was appointed from the House. I'm just wondering what we can do about that.
Thank you, the Chair, Senator Begich. Representative Eastman, you bring up obviously a very, very good point since we've experienced that, the reality of it. This bill is silent on that matter, but it certainly, we would certainly consider language addressing that matter. but it's silent on that matter. So right now, there it creates a conundrum, because on the last day of the prior session, which is the day before convening, the Legislative Council membership and Legislative Budget and Audit membership represents the prior legislature. Once you convened, there are members that are no longer on in the legislature, but who were sitting on that Ledge Council. So you end up with a dearth or an absence of seats and no ability to appoint new members. So you have a conundrum. The bill doesn't address that now. It certainly could.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Clayman.
Through the chair, I'm having a little bit of a math problem when I look at what sounds like a floor amendment in the Senate, which is lines 9 through 14 on page 1, and the provision on page 2 that defines the minority as having at least 25% of the membership in the body. And so if you had a, I'll do the simple math in the Senate, if you had a 16-member majority and a 4-member minority, under this definition, there is no minority. And yet, the first section of the bill would suggest that there should be some proportional representation. And A, you don't have a minority, so in theory, there's no minority entitled to sit. But then in addition, if you had 4 minority members, if I'm doing my math correct, you're at 20%. And that would justify, and of 6 Senate seats, that would justify 1 Senate seat, even though there's no minority. That seems like a math problem, but it's more than a math problem. Can you touch base on that?
Sure. To the chair, to Representative Clayman, it's actually not, because the minority is defined in our uniform rules as having to be, in the case of the Senate, you have to have 5. In fact, if we only had 4, had I elected to join the majority and leave my other 4 colleagues, or if I and another of my colleagues had elected to leave my body, we would not have an official minority. Consequently, when you look at the definition of minority on page 1, it clearly, they would have no seats because there would be no minority. And that is consistent with uniform rules. So right now, our uniform rules do not offer proportional representation, except by the goodness of a presiding officer, to a non-recognized minority. We set that standard in uniform rules. I mean, those rules are set in, those standards are set in uniform rules.
Follow up. So under this statute, in the Senate with 6 members in the minority, how many seats would you be entitled to on Legislative Council of the 6 Senate seats?
We have.
Hi, it's Mercedes Colbert for the record. And I'm sorry, Representative Clayman, through the chair, you said for a 16-member majority in the House?
No. Today you have 6 members in the minority. They qualify as a minority. Mm-hmm. And the question is, if you've got 6 members in the minority today, if this bill becomes law, how many seats does the minority have on Ledge Council?
Through the chair, my understanding through Ledge Legal is the way that Section 1 of the bill will be applied to Ledge Council under the our current caucus, the Senate minority, has 6 members of the minority. And under Uniform Rule 1E, that's that table that you have in your uniform rules that looks like this. That would show, so effectively, we treat each chamber's side of Ledge Council as its own committee in a way, in the way that the appointments work. So with Ledge Council, you have 7 members appointed from the House and 7 members to the Senate. So it's a 7-member committee for each body, but you join them together to make 14 total for Ledge Council. So with a 6-member minority for a 7-member committee, that would put us at 2 members of the minority for the Senate side. Likewise, under, I believe, in the House, we have an 18-member minority. That would put the 18-member House minority at 3 members in Ledge Council.
Follow up. But I'm not, I am raising an argument with you, because the language of this bill makes no reference to the uniform rules. It specifically says the number of seats on the council is proportional to the number of minority members compared to the whole total House membership. So you would be looking at 6/20 applied to 7. It would have nothing to do with the uniform rules, is the way this is written. I mean, am I missing something?
Who's chair, Representative Clayman? This was offered on the Senate floor by a member of the Senate majority on April 12th. Again, as Senator Begich mentioned, it was adopted without objection. And my understanding from the sponsor of the of that amendment, she pointed out to Rule 1E of Uniform Rules, and that language that you see from lines 9 through 14 on page 1 is exactly what you'll find on the within Rule 1E in Uniform Rules. It's the exact same language. And likewise, we have a minority defined in Section 3 of the bill on page 2. That is also directly lifted from Uniform Rules. It's essentially putting Uniform Rule language in statute. It doesn't reference Uniform Rules, but it uses the same language as Uniform Rules.
It's not a question. I just think the language of this bill says you don't look at uniform rules. You do a strict proportional analysis, and based on the proportional analysis, that's how many the minority gets to pick.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And I just wanted to point out that the language here in Section 3 that you're referring to, Representative Clayman, that language actually is found in our Legislative Ethics Act. So of the three statutes that deal with the statutory committees, the Ethics Act already kind of went away. I don't know if it ever actually started, but it went away from pointing to partisan Democrat or Republican members. And so it specifically talks about minority. And so the definition of minority is in statute there. And the math works out that by requiring that at least 25%, that ensures that there can only be one minority, because a majority would be more than 50%. So if you have more than 25%, there's not enough members left to have two minorities, which if you had four-member minority, you could have multiple minorities, because there's enough members to go around. So this definition of minority just means that there's only going to be one, and in that sense, it is following the path that's already been blazed in the legislative ethics side of things with their minority membership and how that's defined. So I think that's a positive. I think that the reference to party membership is a bit archaic. I know not too many years ago, I remember speaking of the other body, the majority, looked around how to follow the law and chose a member of the majority who was a member of another party and decided that that's who they wanted to represent the minority, which doesn't work very well. And just recognizing that, and then also recognizing what's happened with Ledge Council with the House minority membership just this legislature. We as a minority got together and elected a minority leader, selected a member for Ledge Council, and that person was put on Ledge Council, and then the majority came in and basically decided they didn't like our choice. And so they added another member, and then they removed the member that we had chosen. So we effectively had no choice with who the minority was represented on Ledge Council. And so that gamesmanship has happened and probably will continue to happen. I would prefer, and I don't know what the committee feels, but I would prefer that we just make it clear that if there is a minority member or members on a committee, in this case Ledge Council, that the minority leader or the minority caucus gets the chance to choose who is going to represent them rather than leaving that up to a member of the majority to make that selection.
Senator Begich.
Thank you, Senator Begich, for the record. Through the chair, Representative Eastman. You bring up an issue that was debated at length in the Committee of Referral, as well as on the floor, and also within the majority-minority caucuses. And what we were trying to do with the legislation was make it as consistent with uniform rules as we potentially could. I will point out, you're right, that statutory language does exist around the ethics law as defining a minority. But that also directly does come from page one, bottom of the page, last paragraph. It's word for word from uniform rules that's in this. And we tried to draw on uniform rules. Uniform rules does leave the power of appointment in the hands of the presiding officers. And we really did debate that in the Senate. We discussed it. We believe that that is appropriate. We do believe, though, that the minority should be listened to in that process. I wouldn't want to codify that, but what I would, and we've gone back and forth on the codification of that, mainly because that then creates another inconsistency with uniform rules. You know, one thing we probably should consider at some point is adopting new standards, the new rules that are out there. We haven't done that yet. We were using outdated rules as it stands now. And it would be my hope that at some point that we would look thoroughly at all of our uniform rules and make sure that they're applied directly. Right now, we're in a situation where should we not move forward on some sort of representation, minorities, whether I'm in one next year or not, would be subject to once again potentially being denied a seat. And I will say this year, if it hadn't been for the House informing us of actions, we wouldn't have had as much knowledge as to what was happening in Ledge Council and Legislative Budget and Audit. So I appreciate the thoughts. I would suggest that as a starting point, let's just get representation for the minorities consistent with uniform rules. And then let's perhaps next year take a look at our uniform rules and how we apply them in the interests of fairness. And that is in the interest of this bill as well.
Paula?
Different topic.
I think Representative Tarr may have been in the queue with a question.
Well, just on that point, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And so I guess relative to the concerns raised by Representative Eastman, if you, as the bill sponsor, would check into that, I guess, with Ledge Legal, if that language that was added on the Senate floor needs further clarification, and then it was to the questions that Rep. Klayman was raising, I immediately thought of the proportional representation that's included in the uniform rules. I guess if Ledge Legal said we needed to do something to clarify that or, you know, make that better known, then I would support that, but would look for direction from you all on whether that's necessary.
Through the chair, Senator Begich, for the record, Representative Tarr, I want to be clear that I understand. So we would ask them, should there be a direct reference to uniform rules in the statute or not, or if it's necessary, and we'll get that in writing and provide it to the committee.
Thank you. And, you know, always hesitant to make changes to bills that have already come over from the other body and then have to be, you know, go back. So if it's not necessary, that's great. But if you end up feeling it's necessary, thank you.
I'm not hesitant. Senator Representative Eastman.
Nor am I, thank you. With all due respect. I also wanted to point out Uniform Rule 1E, which we've been referring to, does talk about proportional representation, but it's sometimes overlooked that rule only requires that for standing committees. And so Ledge Council is not a standing committee. It's not one of the 10 listed. And Ethics isn't, and LBNA isn't, and none of the special committees are, certainly. So I think there might be good reason to make it more uniform rather than just dealing with the standing committee. So I support that. I wanted to ask, I know that there have been times when I was first joined the legislature, it was one of those times where it was customary for there to be an alternate member on the Ledge Council. And so the majority had an alternate, the minority had an alternate. And I think the rationale for that was a lot of the work that Ledge Council does is not topics that only come up, you know, in one meeting. There's lawsuits that may last, you know, months, if not years. There's executive sessions. And so you can't, you know, if you're trying to stand in for someone, or if you are trying to start understanding, you know, the conversation, you can't go back and necessarily watch the previous meetings if they were in executive session. And so you have an alternate there who's hopefully up to speed on the topic and can stand in and provide a vote on behalf of the minority, the majority, you know, without a lot of extensive, you know, prep time ahead of time. What are your thoughts on continuing that practice and having an alternate available for the Ledge Council, for example?
Through the chair, Senator Begich, Representative Eastman, the Ledge Council statute doesn't provide for an alternate at this time. It hasn't done that. In the legislative and budget statute, it provides for a single alternate. And so it's been an odd situation for my caucus, I must say. Last year in the last legislature, so 2 years ago in the last legislature in 2020, I was appointed to fill a seat on the Ledge Council, and a member of my caucus was appointed as the alternate to serve on the Ledge Council and did have an occasional opportunity to vote when a member of a legislative budget audit, and when a member did not appear on legislative budget audit, they were allowed to vote as the alternate because it's designated, I believe it's designated in the statute. I may be wrong about that. Oh yeah, alternate members is a whole section on it. But the alternate members were designed, there are two on LBNA, and they were the implication was that they were to represent the two parties, but that hasn't been the actuality. The alternates at present on legislative budget audit in the Senate actually are both of the current majority. They're not of our caucus. We have no alternate as well. So I'm very open to the idea of there being alternates for the minority. We kicked that around in a state affairs version of the bill in the Senate to ensure that there would be representation. It various reasons that were technical in nature caused us to get a little convoluted there. So we just passed you the cleanest bill we possibly could with the hope that, notwithstanding Representative Tarr's comment, that you would adjust it in a way that we could support it on the other side when it came back over. That might be an adjustment that would be welcome, that there be alternates available to both a minority and a majority for exactly that reason. I will point out that the designated party minority member has been unable to attend some meetings of Pledge Council and LBNA this year, so we have not even had party representation.
Follow up?
Yeah, and just a comment. I know there was quite a few number of meetings where our minority leader was not able to attend Ledge Council. And the alternate, in that case it was me, sat in. And so if we had not had an alternate, we would have had no one, and that would have been a shame.
Through the chair, Senator Baggage, for the record, Representative Eastman, I think that is a deficit that should be fixed. And I think your proposal and your thoughts on that would be welcome in assuring there were alternates. And I think that would be consistent with our belief in fairness and equity and the belief that's been expressed to me by numerous members of our majority.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Klayman, did you have a question? Further questions from the committee? All right. Well, thank you for the bill presentation, Senator Begich.
May I have a comment?
Oh, no, yes, absolutely, Representative Story.
Thank you. I think in our work, we need the opportunities like these to be bipartisanship and to share voices. So I thank you for bringing this forward.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Story, thank you for entertaining the bill. I never cease to have good dialogue in this committee, and it always seems to, and I've watched the dialogue. It often moves things forward. So I appreciate the opportunity, and I do wish that that we're able to move on this rather rapidly. I'm hopeful, since you've had prior hearings on very similar legislation, that we'll be able to move forward and actually ensure equity and fairness in the next legislature.
I would align myself with Representative Story's comments. I think having served in the minority for, well, less than half my time here, I think it's important not for memory to fade, and just have equitable systems to the greatest extent possible, which I think is something I've felt very strongly, maybe more strongly since being in the majority, or I'd like to think so. In terms of a next hearing, we have this noticed on Thursday. House Bill 66 will be potentially a heavy lift in next week's schedule, but I'm going to set an amendment deadline of submission to legislative legal for SB 66, not HB 66. For submission to legislative legal Tuesday at 5 p.m. and submission to my office Wednesday at 5 p.m. That is for SB 66, the bill that we just heard. Public testimony is also noticed on Thursday. If we need to move things around, we will, with
the workload we have next week, which is another six bills on the Tuesday hearing, but we just dispensed of six bills in an hour 45 minutes, so hopefully we can keep up that pace of work. So thank you very much, Senator Begich and Ms. Colbert, for joining us. And thank you, Sophia and Lydia and Jeff, for facilitating today's hearing. And at 4:50, we are adjourned.